history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there waiting to be heard. If only we'll ask a few questions and take the time to listen. Each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take this journey, we're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories. And today we're in Las Vegas, Nevada with 90-year-old Selwyn Dante, originally, well, born in Arkansas, but spent a good chunk of his life in Louisiana, just moved here from Houston, Texas 6 months ago, and has already had the adventure of a lifetime with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. We'll get to that. But Selwyn, I want to talk about this early stuff, because you don't remember it, I'm sure, but early on your life was affected by a natural disaster. It was a flood that chased your family out of Arkansas?
That's right. Moved there with friends in Louisiana, North Louisiana.
In 1927?
1927. I was 6 months old.
You're wearing an LSU Tigers shirt, so I imagine life in
Louisiana. I'm a member of LSU Alumni Federation. That's my school.
I can tell you're very proud, and I'm surprised you haven't added a like EAUX to the end of your name or anything by now. But growing up in Louisiana, what was life like there in the South before World War II?
It was good. We didn't know anything about color differences. I played with blacks and whites.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the hardest hit I ever got was against playing catcher on a softball team for a black man that was swinging a bat. He caught me behind my ear, broke my eardrum, and fractured my skull. I'm standing, walking around, oh, help me, help me, help me. They took me to the hospital in Monroe, the nearest place from Winsboro, where I was living. And I said, all you got is a fractured skull. You'll get over it.
All you got is a fractured skull.
I got over it very well. Didn't hurt me one bit.
Monroe is in northeast Louisiana.
Right.
Beautiful spot there along the, what is it, the Ouachita River runs through
there? Ouachita River, correct.
Yep. In fact, General Claire Chennault lived in Monroe for a long time, a World War II hero.
He was born in Gilbert, Louisiana, just south of Winsboro.
Mm-hmm.
9 miles away. I know where his home is, 9 miles south of Winsboro.
Did you know that at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys hear the stories of the Flying Tigers?
Oh, yes. I knew all about them. We'd go down and see his house every once in a while. He was our first big hero.
I believe it. And since then, of course, Northeastern Louisiana University used to be the Indians. They changed it to the Warhawks because
right.
of the P-40 Warhawk that his Flying Tiger pilots flew in China during World War II. And now if you go to Monroe, they have a great General Chennault Flying Tigers Museum right there by the airport. But you, as a young man, you knew who he was. And
oh, yes.
That was a big deal.
Followed his exploits for quite a bit.
If you were following his exploits, you were aware that there was some turmoil in the world before America got into it.
Absolutely.
Was that kind of exciting that a guy from around your area was doing this big stuff in China?
That was very good.
Were you dreaming of being a Flying Tiger pilot?
No.
You weren't going that far.
I tried for the Air Force when I was at LSU. Went over to try to enlist in the Air Force and couldn't pass the test. I didn't have enough weight on me. I weighed 111 pounds. And I wanted to be a pilot. I had to put on some weight. I'd eat a couple of bananas and try to see if I could hit the weight, but I didn't make it, so I went back to school.
Everybody seems to have a memory about December 7th, 1941, where they were, how they found out. Is that true in your case?
I remember exactly where I was. I was in my backyard playing in Winsboro, Louisiana, and they told us about the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And I'm a geography buff. I knew exactly where it was, what they were talking about. I had to just see what was going on. Turned the radio, and sat and listened to the radio for a long, long time. And then, of course, Monday, he declared war.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew once these days I'd be going pretty soon if I didn't finish it up in a hurry.
Well, because you were still in high school.
Yeah. I graduated at 17. And my first year, I went to Northeast Louisiana for one semester, then transferred to LSU. I remember very vividly listen to the radio of how bad it was. And then seeing those first pictures, it was terrible.
Did it make you want to do something about it?
Not enough to want to volunteer at my age. I was still a little bit young.
Yeah. So you finished high school and went off to junior college in LSU.
Then LSU. I enjoyed my time at Northeast because it was the first time I'd been up to college. It was only 30 miles away. A big difference.
Baton Rouge is a little further.
You're right. I used to love to hitchhike back and forth.
Yeah, you could do that back then, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. No problem at all.
But you were drafted while you were there at LSU?
Yes.
How'd you feel about that?
Whatever was going to be, going to be. I didn't worry about it. I just accepted what came along.
You mentioned you had tried to enlist in the Army Air Corps. They didn't take you.
Wouldn't take me.
But now, with the way things are going, they need some soldiers, and they call your number.
They drafted me. I went to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, then to Oklahoma, Fort Sill, Oklahoma. That's where I took basic training. And when I finished basic training, they immediately shipped me out, got me overseas.
Yeah, they needed people there in a hurry.
To replace the Battle of Bulge people that had been shot and killed and wounded.
And that was thousands and thousands, and you would end up on the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge. But I'm curious about, you know, that journey overseas, because here you are, a very young man.
Gosh, I was only 18, I believe.
So you're 18 years old.
18 years old.
And you're taking this voyage across the Atlantic. Had you ever been on a ship before?
Yes, but a small one.
You mean like on the river?
Yeah.
A river in the south is a far cry from the Atlantic Ocean.
I'd never taken a cruise before, that's what you're getting at.
Yeah. Were you anxious? Were you nervous? Were you wondering what you were going to encounter over there?
Not particularly. It was all a new experience for me. I was wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to go where it was going to be.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember kind of what you expected, what you thought it was going to be like?
Well, I knew that I'd already lost a cousin in the war and had other members of my family that had been gone in the war. I just looked forward to whatever's going to come is going to come. I'm quite a fatalist in that respect.
What happened with your cousin? Did you know the story?
Missing in action from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Leon Brown.
Did you know him much at all?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Just knew that he was your cousin.
He's older than I am.
So you're 18 years old. You make it across the Atlantic?
I went on a motion liner from the Matson Lines called the Mariposa. It was fast enough to go by itself. It didn't have to have an escort and a convoy. New York, Camp Shanks to Liverpool, England. We were starting to go into the southern part, but they had a submarine attack. So I sent completely around Ireland to land at Liverpool and put me on a train, sent me to Southampton to get across the channel.
When you say they had a submarine attack, you mean on your ship or in the area?
In the area. So to keep them going to that dangerous area, they turned around the ship, went around Ireland completely to land in Liverpool.
And here, you'd still been in the States in June of 44 when America and the Allies invade Normandy. I'm sure you'd seen all those photos.
I followed. That's why I was so glad I happened to land on Omaha Beach.
You knew the significance.
Absolutely.
How many guys had died to take that beach?
Many thousands.
What did you see when you got there in January?
Oh, the beach had been cleared completely. It had a wharf built up for ships to dock there. Didn't have to get my feet wet at all.
But you'd be getting your feet wet in terms of war pretty soon. Was there a moment that was kind of the welcome to the war moment for you?
I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed then. Nothing affected me too much. Whatever was going to happen, I just look forward to see something different. As long as I keep my wits about me and stay alive, that was the main thing.
And I know you had some close calls over there. You ended up attached to the 84th Infantry Division, the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion. But what was your specific job?
Well, when I joined the outfit, the Battle of the Bulge was just about ending, and they put me in headquarters company. Usually there are four enlisted men in headquarters company. They had all been killed. So I took care of all four men's positions.
Four different positions. What were those four?
Operations, intelligence, service, and supply. I was a sergeant for all of those outfits. I was a PFC.
Wow. I guess that kind of underscores the desperate nature of the situation.
You're right.
And the losses they had taken. Was that intimidating at all to know how many guys had died in this Battle of the Bulge that you caught the tail end of?
No, I expected the worst.
And how about the weather when you got there?
It was still rather cold. It was still snow on the ground in a lot of places. I had warmer clothes than they had in the Bulge battle. Most of them, part of the Battle of the Bulge, didn't have warm enough clothing. I'm jumping ahead of myself a minute. One of the men of the Battle of the Bulge, I'd never seen anybody else from my outfit, the 84th Infantry Division, or any of its detachments before, until I moved into an old folks' home in Houston.
Uh-huh.
Man I met there, he was in the Battle of the Bulge and the foxhole, and the water was up to his calves. His feet were frozen. Had to chop him out, and they wanted to cut his legs off. When he said, heck no, you're not coming there. Send him to the hospital in England, then send him home. And then I got to meet him. So that's the only time I've met anybody from my outfit ever and all my traveling.
All these years since. So you didn't have to deal with the harshest winter conditions that a lot of those guys at the Bulge did.
We were equipped with enough clothing to take care of it.
you mentioned to me that you're lucky to be here. And maybe some folks just hearing that story of your baseball injury, just a fractured skull, that they know you're thankful to be here. What were some of those close calls you experienced there in Europe?
Well, as I told you, I was at headquarters company of the battalion. So I drove the Jeep with an adjutant, First Lieutenant Sabi, and we led the convoy. Mm-hmm. And we had those dadgum tree-lined areas, hedgerows, that's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah.
On the right-hand side and a forest on the left-hand side. And we got strafed by FW-190, had 37-millimeter cannons on it instead of machine guns. It started at the back of the column. By the time we got to the front of the column, a shell hit right behind my Jeep. It was a dud, bounced over my Jeep into a ditch. I was very lucky.
It hit behind your Jeep.
And bounced over my head.
Over your head.
Into the ditch on the side. You could see the thing smoking, but it went off. We went in the woods. Everybody cleared out of the vehicles and ran in the woods. We didn't want to get strafed anymore. So after that first strafing, he decided he'd just leave us alone.
What would have happened if that shell was not a dud?
It would have killed me.
No question.
No question. It was only about 4.5-5 feet behind me.
Where it bounced, if it had detonated there.
It would have killed me immediately.
Would have blown your Jeep over and...
Yeah.
Yep.
Killed both of us. 37-millimeter shell can give a pretty good explosion.
Well, and I wonder what the percentage is. What percentage of those shells were actually duds?
I don't think they had hardly any more of them.
Pretty rare.
I was very lucky. You have very seldom of time of a shell from a machine gun or a cannon being a dud. I'd never heard it before in my life.
What you do hear occasionally is that some of those were sabotaged and that the slave labor they had working in some of these camps, that they would, at the risk of their life, sabotage the shell to try to make it a dud. I mean, I guess that's a possibility there.
I never considered that thought. I
mean, who knows? It could have just been a dud. Maybe it was divine intervention.
You're right.
Nobody knows.
I never heard of any other person being strafed with the cannons and it being hit by, missed by a dud like that. The tanker store right behind me, the shell hit behind it, and a guy in the tanker store got a Purple Heart because he got hit.
Mm-hmm. So that was...
I was just lucky. Somebody looking out for me, I guess. When we went overseas, I forgot to tell you this. It was an important thing. My dad had an apartment store in Winsboro, and he had a seamstress in there working for him, and they would alter the clothes for the people that bought clothes. When I got on the ship, we were out in the middle of the Atlantic, and somebody called my name up on the second level. Turned around, and said, the man's, his mother worked for my father, Ray Clausen. He was a P-47 pilot, second lieutenant. He came down. I couldn't go up to see him, of course, because that's the officer's quarters, apparently.
Right.
He came down and talked to him for a while, and he promised to wire my folks when he got to Europe where I was, because I couldn't do any connecting with them at all. It was all top secret where I was going to. And he said he'd take care of it and let them know I was. That made him happy.
Did he do that?
Oh, yeah. I never did find out what happened to him at the end of the war. I don't know. I didn't follow up on a lot of things I probably should have followed up on.
But you know that he did follow through and let your parents know where you were.
Yeah, no, because I got... No letters from him, email from him, to let me know what's going on. I'm a horrible correspondent. I didn't want to send anything back. I'm able to send 2 or 3 emails my entire time overseas.
Well, Mr. Dante was not able to keep in touch, but I am able now to fill in a couple of those blanks. That P-47 pilot who helped him out, Ray Clausen, did make it home from the war. He ended up as a flight instructor back home in northern Louisiana, and he was in business at the small airport in their hometown there for quite a while. In fact, if you go to the renovated Winsboro Municipal Airport today, you'll step into the Clausen Adams Terminal Building, bearing the name of Sal Dante's late friend. Ray Clausen passed away in 1994. He's buried there in Franklin Parish, Louisiana. And his grave marker reads, "A good man, a good pilot." I'm going to try to put Mr. Dante in touch with Mr. Clausen's family, but after this break, we're going to jump back into Sal's story, including an important detail that he'll share, adding some powerful perspective as to what he was fighting for in Europe during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.